From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, Slums of Beverly Hills, we talk with Tamara Jenkins about her film comedy, which is loosely based on her teenage years when her father was close to broke and they lived in dumpy apartments in a high-class zip code so the kids could go to good public schools. The film just came out on video. Also, Ben Folds of the Ben Folds Five, a rock trio with no guitars but a sense of humor. The band has a new album out and is on tour. And book critic Maureen Corrigan recommends books for summer reading. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Russia's Balkans envoy, Viktor Chernomyrdin, met today in Belgrade with Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic and said he was satisfied with the talks aimed at ending the conflict over Kosovo. He didn't give any details of the talks, but Yugoslavia's state-run news agency said Milosevic has agreed to the general principles set out by the group of eight nations. Deputy Secretary of State Strobe Talbot was less optimistic, stressing that Chernomyrdin is representing the Russian point of view and is not negotiating on behalf of the U.S. or NATO. According to U.S. officials, North Korea has allayed concerns about an underground construction site. The Clinton administration once thought that the underground complex might conceal evidence that the North planned to resume nuclear weapons production. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
After lengthy U.S.-North Korean negotiations and a promise by Washington to send more emergency food to the North, Pyongyang allowed American inspectors to visit the suspect site last week. What they found, said State Department spokesman James Rubin, was an extensive, empty tunnel complex. He called it a hole in the ground. Rubin said there is no basis to conclude that North Korea is in violation of the agreed framework, a reference to the 1994 deal in which the North promised to freeze its nuclear weapons program in exchange for economic assistance from the United States, Japan, and South Korea. Rubin said the United States has the right to re-inspect the underground site. He said, "We expect to go back on a number of occasions." Ted Clark, NPR News, Washington.
Russia's government was thrown into turmoil once again after the recently appointed first deputy prime minister called it quits. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports from Moscow.
First Deputy Prime Minister Mikhail Zadornov backed away from what most Russian analysts portrayed as a fierce behind-the-scenes battle for power within Russia's new government. Zadornov told the Moscow news conference that President Boris Yeltsin has signed a decree formally dismissing him from office. Zadornov was unhappy he could not serve simultaneously as first deputy prime minister and finance minister, a post he held in previous governments. The moderate reformer was also competing against another first deputy prime minister, Nikolai Aksyonenko, who has been trying to carve out a larger role for himself in running the economy. Aksyonenko is widely believed to have powerful backers within Yeltsin's inner circle. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Moscow.
MCI WorldCom said today that it's buying the pager company SkyTel Communications for nearly $1.3 billion in stock. The announcement follows a week of speculation. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials gained 92 points to close at 10,559. This is NPR. A man who abducted his two daughters 20 years ago has pleaded guilty to kidnapping. Stephen Fagan entered the plea in a Massachusetts courtroom in exchange for a suspended prison sentence and a $100,000 fine. After a bitter custody battle with his former wife, Fagan admitted kidnapping the children, taking them to Florida, changing their names, and telling them that their mother was dead. He said he was protecting the girls, claiming his former wife was an alcoholic. Fagan's daughters have supported him throughout and refused to be reacquainted with their mother. Two federal government websites are offline today after attacks by computer hackers. NPR's Chad Pergram reports.
The FBI website was taken down by the Bureau after hackers unsuccessfully tried to compromise it. And on Capitol Hill, the sergeant-at-arms shut down the Senate site after hackers published an obscene message there. Investigators say the message blamed the invasion on what was called government attacks on other hacker groups. It was not clear whether the incidents with the FBI and Senate websites were directly related. Hackers also altered some other federal and state government websites. A hacker message on a site for the Commonwealth of Virginia said, quote, "We think it's payback time now." Technical experts from the Senate were meeting with the FBI to try to get the sites back up and to enhance security measures. The FBI says its site might not return until next week. Chad Pergram, NPR News, Washington.
Experts are predicting crowded highways for this Memorial Day weekend. The American Automobile Association says more than 33 million people will be traveling, and most of them by car. The travel club said the strong economy is responsible for increasing Memorial Day traffic by 4%. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, makers of cholesterol-free vegetable oil, ADM, supermarket to the world, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The movie Slums of Beverly Hills has just come out on video. On this archive edition, we have an interview with the writer and director of the film, Tamara Jenkins. Slums of Beverly Hills is set in the 70s. Vivian Abramowitz, her father, and two brothers have come to Los Angeles in search of the good life. Unfortunately, they don't have enough money for the good life. The father wants to at least live in a good zip code to enable the kids to go to good schools. So they live in Beverly Hills' cheap apartments with fancy names like Casabella and the Beverly Capri. As the film opens, the father, played by Alan Arkin, can't even pay the month's rent on their dumpy apartment. He makes a quick getaway from the landlord by rounding up the kids, getting them in the car, and taking off. And they prepare to move to a new dump.
I'm sick of moving. Why can't we ever stay put? It's not normal to move every 3 months.
It's normal in some cultures. Nomads, they move.
Stupid, Ben. We're not nomads. We're Americans. So where's our new apartment this time?
We're staying in Beverly Hills. It's just too early to show up is all. We want to make a good impression. We want to show up at a leisurely hour. We don't want to look like we just got kicked out of someplace else like bums.
We didn't get kicked out of someplace else like bums. We made a getaway like crooks.
What did you say?
Nothing.
We made a choice. We moved like people. That place was a shithole at those prices. Highway robbery.
Fine.
Okay, who's hungry?
Me.
What do you say we get some steak? Let's get some steak for breakfast.
Yeah.
Isn't it a little early for steak?
No, it'll be fun. We'll eat, we'll get our strength up, then we'll move into a new place. What do you say?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's go to Sizzler.
That was Natasha Lyonne as Vivian Abramowitz. The character comes out of the life of the film's writer and director, Tamara Jenkins. She made the film with the help of the Sundance Institute Screenwriting and Filmmakers Lab and Robert Redford, the film's executive producer. I spoke with Jenkins last summer when the film was released theatrically, and she told me that when she was young, her family had to move a lot because of money trouble.
We were economically disabled.
How'd you get that way?
I guess is a good word. My dad had he was a car salesman, and he was selling American cars, huge American Fords in 1976. So, they weren't really selling so well at the time. There was a big gas problem, and no one was interested in buying those big American cars. That was one sort of issue. And he was an elderly man bringing up this family of kids. And he, in real life, which isn't really explored in the movie except in a sort of like quick way, he had a gambling problem. We spent a lot of time at the track and Hollywood Park and Del Mar and Las Vegas.
What did you think of Las Vegas as a kid?
Well, there's this place in Las Vegas, which I don't even know if it exists anymore, but when we were growing up, there was a you know, casino hotel complex called Circus Circus. They had trapeze artists and stuff suspended above your head and falling into nets, and that was happening above the casino floor. And what they did to sort of entertain the children of compulsive gamblers was they had an arcade of, you know, games. You know, it was sort of like learning how to become a compulsive gambler, where you would like line up and play, you know, various arcade games, you know, pinball-y kind of things, or the sort of things that you'd see at a, you know, on a boardwalk fairway. And play for sort of chips. So I guess it's kind of training for, you know, compulsive gambling.
Did you like being there?
No, it was a very, I don't know. It was always sort of surreal place to be. I mean, it was, And I don't think I had the sort of awareness that it wasn't the right place for kids to be hanging out sort of around, you know, casinos. It was something that was pretty familiar to me. So I certainly haven't gone back to visit as a grown-up.
In the movie The Slums of Beverly Hills, the father wants the kids to have a Beverly Hills zip code so they can go to good public schools. So he just keeps bringing them to the cheapest places he can find within that zip code. So did you end up going to Beverly Hills schools?
I did.
Were you the only...
I confess.
Were you, like, one of the few people of your economic class the schools you went to?
There was a sort of a subculture of people that lived there that were poor, and particularly then. I mean, not maybe as poor or different kinds of poor, but there was a kind of... There was a lot of the divorce decade. There was tons of divorced people around that period of time. There was the street across the street. We lived at one point on the street called Arnaz Drive in Beverly Hills, and the nickname of it was Divorce Drive because all the kids on the street, you know, the parents, they were broken homes or whatever. And as a grown-up, I thought it was kind of like if there was a Dickens in Beverly Hills, it would be on Arnaz Drive because they were just all these kind of dirty kids running around unsupervised and hanging out on the street. And there seemed to be this whole group of people like that. I mean, we weren't the only ones, but there seemed to be this whole sort of divorce fallout, and a lot of them, you know, there was like a little culture of poor people or sort of struggling people, people that you wouldn't expect to be in Beverly Hills that were living there.
Anyone seeing your movie, The Slums of Beverly Hills, will want to hear what your experience was shopping for your first bra. In the movie, at the age of 15, the main character is taken by her father to shop for her first bra, and he just keeps saying all kinds of incredibly embarrassing things during this already embarrassing experience. And by the time her father takes her for the first bra, she's a size C. She's a C cup. So this has been something that should have been done quite a while ago. So what was your first experience?
Well, I'm sort of verging on a C cup. I think I should tell you that, Terry, because we're not in the same room. But I think that in the case with my father, I had a phys ed teacher tell me that it was time to, you know, to get harnessed. And she gave me some sort of note, and I had been sort of hiding them, you know. I do recall kind of, you know, submitting this note to my father after school and him, you know, like grabbing me and throwing me into the car as if he was dragging me off to the emergency room, you know.
And what was the experience like when you got to the... Did he take you to a department store?
He took me to a department store, to a lingerie section of a department store. Actually, looked for a sales lady to sort of do the dirty work. I mean, he wasn't, you know, rifling through piles of bras or anything. That was in the days that you could smoke in department stores. And I remember him kind of like drifting off through those, you know, those little circle displays of bras and stuff and kind of drifting off to this... by the elevators where there were those ashtrays that connected to the walls and smoking and waiting for me to become finished. But he did sort of have to introduce me. And I think that he felt like it was awkward eventually and drifted off to the ashtray where it was safe.
Natasha Lyonne plays the part of the 15-year-old girl who's at the center of the slums of Beverly Hills. And this character is loosely based on you when you were that age. So what was it like to work with an actress who's more or less playing you, and you're directing her, you've written the part for her?
Well, I mean, she is a sort of alter ego character, but she's a much more idealized version of myself than I am. I mean, she's much more aware and conscious and truly a fictional creature. You know, I was really, when I met, I auditioned a lot of girls for the role and really fell for her when I met her. And I guess the thing that was the most attractive to me about her was that she was an unfinished person in the best way, whereas a lot of the actresses I was interviewing were very polished and complete people and, you know, really poised and certainly more ladylike and together than I'd ever be. And Natasha had this kind of just unfinished gawkiness about her that I really responded to. There were a lot of things in terms of having her. I mean, I guess the most sort of, you know, there was a lot of work that we did in terms of getting her prepared for the role. I guess the most kind of, you know, silly but true and important part was the fact that Natasha Lyonne has quite small breasts, you know, just naturally. So we had to enhance this. I mean, not because I was, you know, a pervert and wanted an actress with big breasts, but because the role called for a girl with size C breasts. So we had to give her these prosthetic breast things that are sort of gelatinous and pretty real looking. And I guess that was like a big moment between us, which was her coming to a rehearsal, me handing over these breasts to her, her putting them in a bra. And sort of when she first put them on, she was incredibly excited about them because she just kind of got them handed to her. And she said, "These are great. I love these breasts." And she was kind of cavorting around the rehearsal studio. And then I said, "Well, you know, the character of Vivian is kind of has a, you know, antagonistic relationship with her breasts. So go out into the world, deal with life with your breasts, and come back and let's talk about your experience." So she sort of left, you know, breasts flung forward into the universe. And then she came back all concaved and uncomfortable and awkward and sort of hiding her body. And that was a very pivotal exercise. It was actually perfect in a way that her breasts were, you know, because she, it was something that she had to just quickly learn how to contend with, sort of the way adolescence assaults you if in fact you get a set of breasts, or the kind of public nature of female development.
What was it that she found discouraging about suddenly having two large breasts?
Yeah, she felt that the world became a predatory place. So she went to grocery stores, or I don't know what she did. She sort of spent the day and said people were kind of, you know, sexualizing her or commenting upon her or, you know, catcalling her in a way that she had never experienced before.
My guest is Tamara Jenkins. She wrote and directed the new film Slums of Beverly Hills. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tamara Jenkins. She wrote and directed the new film Slums of Beverly Hills. Before you were born, your father ran a strip club?
Yes.
How much did he tell you about that?
He told me very little about it. In fact, I only figured it out because I was doing some investigative reporting on my own life. I became kind of the weird family archivist, and we, you know, the family is very sort of splattered in lots of different places. But I had returned to my mother's house in Philadelphia, and after many years, and started digging through this pile of, like, a shoebox, a classic shoebox of family photographs, and discovered these photographs of a stripper named Blaze Starr.
Famous stripper.
Yeah, Miss Spontaneous Combustion herself. That's what she was called. And she used to strip, and it's a place in Philadelphia, this place called the Black Cat, where she used to strip at my father's nightclub, and it was on Latimer Street. I think it was on 15th and Latimer. Does that make sense?
Yes.
It does? Okay. It's this tiny club that on 15th and Latimer that he would reinvent over and over and over again into different incarnations because, you know, something would, you know, he had this gambling problem. So he would either blow the sort of income, you know, via his gambling problems, or he'd blow the income via, you know, like problems with taxes or whatever. So every time one of these businesses, which was always a sort of restaurant business, failed, he would reinvent it. So at one point it was a supper club called The Glass Door in like 1948 or something. I only know that because it said 1948 on one of the photographs. And then it was, you know, The Black Cat. I'm probably doing it out of order. And then, you know, he had a sort of Polynesian fantasy kind of tiki, you know, place called the Bali High. And then it was, so anyway, it went through all these various, the Mayfair House, which I think was sort of like a classy steakhouse. So he had all of these clubs that he, you know, he'd reinvent over and over again. So anyway, while, you know, digging through this pile of photographs, I came upon, you know, Miss Spontaneous Combustion herself. You got to notice it. And there was a picture of my mother next to the stripper. And I started doing research into what their life was like, because no one really told me. I do have an older brother who was, you know, much more aware of what was going on because he was alive and a grown-up. And so I started doing all this research and then found a biography that Blaze Starr had written, you know, via with someone else that had mentioned my father's nightclub. And Rizzo, who, you know, then became the mayor of Philadelphia, used to raid his club because he was police Captain Frank Rizzo, and he would raid my father's nightclub periodically. And my father would go in the paddy wagon with Blaze Starr. I know this is totally off off the subject of the movie, but it was pretty amazing, especially with all that Philadelphia history. It's pretty hilarious.
When you came upon this, did you think, like, isn't that great? My father was such a colorful character. Or did you think, do you think this is really embarrassing? My father ran a strip club.
I think I was kind of blown away by a lot of it. I mean, I was really blown away to find a pink biography by some, you know, like, stripper that actually had quotes from my father, these silly quotes, like, you know, regarding Rizzo saying that son of a bitch is going to, you know, close down every stripping club in Philadelphia. Don't worry, Blaze. I'll get us out. You know, these kind of insane, you know, in the back of paddy wagons. I guess I was kind of blown away about this history of his, this kind of, I wasn't ashamed. I was amazed that he had had so many different kinds of lives. And, you know, and that he had ended up, you know, and that at the end of his life, he sort of, or not at the end, but at the sort of autumn-ish years of his life, he was bringing up his kids on the outskirts of Beverly Hills. He was, his, you know, a kind of an amazing character.
How did your father end up bringing the kids up after the divorce?
He used to disappear a lot and when we were young. I mean, I must have been 5 or 6 when he totally disappeared. He used to kind of just disappear, and then eventually he'd kind of come back, but I was kind of pre-conscious. I was really young. But then I remember one sort of extended period of time where he was just not around anymore. Like, a couple months had gone by. I really think it took a couple months for me to say, Mom, what happened to, you know, Dad? And then she said, oh, he moved away. He went to Beverly Hills, which even to my 5-year-old mind suggested, like, this amazing, like, Oz. I didn't know what it was. I'd never been there. But, you know, through TV or whatever, you know, some way I knew that Beverly Hills meant something spectacular and fancy. And I kept thinking it was like Oz. And then not long after he had gone out there, he sort of started sending for us, like, one at a time. We staggered. One brother would go, and then I'd stay with my mother, and then another brother would go. And we just sort of ended up out there with him.
Did you want to go?
I think I was pretty, you know, unconscious in a way. I was just in the way that the kids get into a car and they don't know what's going on, and all of a sudden they're being sort of dragged off to another apartment without much explanation. I really experienced life in that kind of kid way where, you know, there was a captain of the ship and they were driving and you kind of just had to go along with what, you know, whatever. I mean, I guess that's sort of the essence of childhood in some ways, at least for me. It just felt like there were these authorities running the ship and they weren't conferring with me. I was just being taken places.
What was your father's final years like?
He died while I was making the movie, actually. So we had been estranged for a really long time. And it was only when I went out to Los Angeles, because I was flown to Los Angeles to do some work in preparation for the film. You know, we were like, I was meeting casting directors and meeting line producers, and I hadn't talked to my father in many years. He had been living with a woman who had essentially been supporting him, and she became ill. And he became ill, and everybody, sort of this infrastructure was falling apart. And I went out there, and he had just gone into the hospital, and I hadn't seen him in, like, I don't know, over 10 years. And he was in pretty bad shape, actually. And me and my big brother ended up taking care of him and flying him from the West Coast to the East Coast to be closer to us. And we had to put him in a nursing home, and but spent time with him pretty much up until the end. Except I was making the movie when he died, and so I wasn't right there.
My guest is Tamara Jenkins, and she wrote and directed the new film, The Slums of Beverly Hills. Now, Robert Redford is the executive producer of your movie. How did he get to be that involved with it?
I met Robert Redford at the, I was invited to the Sundance Institute, which has two components. It has a writer's lab and a director's lab. And I had met him, you know, at the writer's lab. It was a winter writing workshop, and it was a couple years ago. And he approached me. It's actually kind of a funny sort of meeting a movie star story, because I was having a really bad, just having a really low self-esteem moment where he was crossing the room, and it was very funny. You know, all these young writers, you don't have to be young, emerging, not everybody's necessarily young, but emerging script writers are invited, selected for, you know, this thing, which is pretty great. I used to call it the Fresh Air Fund for filmmakers, because they'd fly you out of, you know, the East Village or wherever you were living, and you'd go to this beautiful place in Utah, and you'd get to, you know, work on your screenplay. It's pretty impressive. And they feed you and house you, and you're in this gloriously beautiful place. So, Robert Redford's sitting in front, in that kind of the way you'd imagine from like a Sundance, you know, catalog. He's sitting in front of a roaring fire, crackling fireplace, and he's in a ski suit and has just, you know, there's like powder on his shoulders, sort of like, you know, dandruff, but in this case it's snow, and has just kind of taken off his skis, and he's introducing himself and saying, "I'm Robert," as if he needs to. "Hi, I'm Robert Redford, and thank you for attending the, you know, the writer's workshop." And he goes around the room, and everyone's sitting there, and they introduce themselves. "My name is Tamara Jenkins. I'm here with a project called Slums of Beverly Hills. I'm Chris Ayer. I'm here with this project called Smoke Signal." So we're all going around, and the mentors are introducing themselves. "I'm Steve Zaley, and blah, blah, blah. I'm a writer, and I'm here as a mentor." So, you know, there was that introduction, and it was very polite. And then afterwards, everyone got up and started sipping, you know, wine out of styrofoam cups, and we were supposed to be milling around. And Robert Redford, I was standing in this little cluster of people, and he started approaching, kind of like heading towards this direction where there was this cluster of people, where I was. And I said, "Oh my God, Robert Redford's coming this way. He must want to talk to somebody here, so I guess I should leave. I mean, I should walk away, because he's trying to talk to somebody important, and I don't want to be rude and overhear, so I'll just walk away." Like I was, you know, the waitress. And I sort of turned away to walk, and he put his hand on my shoulder, and I swung around, and I went, "Bleh." And he said, what does a New York girl know so much about Beverly Hills for? You know, or some question like that. And I said, and then my self-esteem moment turned into just obnoxious moment. And I said, "Get out of here. You didn't read that. You couldn't possibly have read all of these screenplays that come through here." And then he said, "Yes, I did. I read your screenplay." And I quizzed him on it. He passed. And then he told me that he had grown up in Southern California as a pretty, you know, as an underclassman, as a poor person, and used to drive through Beverly Hills and wreak havoc. And he really responded to the material. And that was kind of our first meeting. And then he sicked his producer on me, this man named Michael Nozick, who's a really nice guy who runs his low-budget production kind of company called South Fork. And Michael kind of courted me, and, you know, producer-wise, and you know, stayed in touch with me while I was working on the script, and eventually I signed on with him.
Tamara Jenkins, she wrote and directed the film Slums of Beverly Hills. It just came out on video. Our interview was recorded last summer. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. By Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. And by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Ben Folds of the Ben Folds Five. The band has a new CD. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan recommends some books for summer reading.
From the back of your big brown eyes, I knew you'd be gone as soon as you could. And I hoped you would.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Ben Folds Five is a rock trio with no guitar, led by a pianist who loves punk rock and show tunes, and was described in People magazine as fitting somewhere between Little Richard and Billy Joel. Ben Folds is the lead singer and principal songwriter of the band, which is based in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. After several years of playing small clubs around the country, Ben Folds Five became quite popular a couple of years ago. Their CD, Whatever and Ever Amen, included the song Brick, which became a hit single. The group has a new CD called The Unauthorized Biography of Reinhold Messner, and they're currently on tour. On this archive edition, we have an interview with Ben Folds, recorded in April of 1998. Before we hear it, let's listen to a track from the new CD. This is Army.
Well, I thought about the army. Dad said, son, you're f***ing high. And I thought, yeah, there's a first for everything. So I took my old man's advice. Three sad semesters. It was only 15 grand. Spinning bed, I thought about the army. I dropped out and joined a band instead.
One of the things I find interesting about this band is how forward Ben Folds' voice usually is in the mix, unlike some bands which nearly bury the singer behind the guitars. Last year I asked Folds about that.
Lyrics are important to me, and I also, I mean, I'm not like a strong, like loud singer, and I think it's better if it's all about the song and the words, to go ahead and put the singer way out there so it doesn't sound as if you're apologizing for something, too. I like to just put it way up there, and it's about the song, and that's it.
Why is there no guitar in the band? To me, it doesn't seem that unusual, though I know it's a big deal for everyone. It seems perfectly acceptable to me to have a band without a guitar and to be piano-based.
I think that's a great answer. I mean, we never thought about having a guitar, really. I mean, I'm sure I've answered it in a thousand different ways, depending on what my mood was. But at the same time, it's just like it really never was an issue. I don't see what's unusual about that either. It's just that there's no guitar, and after all, I mean, who wouldn't want to be a little bit different if possible? You know what I mean? It's like we're not freaks or anything, but I would like to. I like to make some kind of niche or something different or offer something different, and the lack of guitar seems to be a nice, you know, a nice change.
Did you once describe the band as punk rock for sissies?
Yeah, and that got quoted a lot for, I guess because it was in our bio. But I think that was that, you know, that was right at a time, too, where to qualify anything new in music, you had to call it punk somehow. It's a weird thing because some of the worst crap bands in the world I've ever heard are punk bands, and I don't want to be a punk band at all. But it was kind of funny that people would equate us with punk in some way, and so I said, well, if we're punk, then it's certainly punk rock for sissies.
I know that there were times, and I don't think you still have to do this, where you had to carry your own piano around with you on tour because you'd play in places where there wasn't a piano or where you were expected to bring a crummy little synthesizer with you.
Yeah.
You don't still have to do that, do you?
No, the first two and a half years that we toured, and we were touring like really, really constantly in the U.S., we carried my piano, just me and the band, and one extra guy. And we carried, it was a baby grand piano, and every single, I'm not talking about like nice clubs, we're talking about like punk clubs and, you know, five bands on the bill and you know, just really kind of not so great conditions. But I think it was a really, really cool context for people to see a real piano in, too. The same places that some punk band had played 5 minutes before, you're seeing a real piano, and I think that was kind of a cool thing.
I suppose there was room for a grand piano.
Man, you can make room anywhere. It's amazing. We've put it up on, like where the legs wouldn't all fit, just put it up on a chair or on the side of the stage.
Oh,
I mean, we substitute so many things for the legs of that piano. It can be done. Well, we were insane, really. I mean, I think about it. There was something wrong with us.
Why do you say that?
Because the drive and the energy it took to move that piano from state to state was, I mean, I can't believe how much work that was, really, when I think about it. Because you have to get there very early. You have to be in a certain, you know, just the kind of vehicle that you have to drive around and buy to do that. And where you have to park it and getting it up steps and on the stage and after the show, then you're there for like a long time getting it off the stage and into the truck, and it's crazy. It really is a lot of work.
All right. Well, I want to play another track.
All right.
That's right. I want to play another track from your CD. It's a track called Stephen's Last Night in Town. And this is, I first of all, I think the lyric is very funny in this. It's kind of about, you know, the guest who wouldn't leave, the guy who is forgiven for a lot of things because, well, he's leaving town tomorrow, so he could get away with anything.
Right.
And another thing on this track is that a few of the musicians from the Klezmatics, which is a klezmer band, is on this too. So it's a kind of unusual, interesting sound. Tell me about the story, the story behind the song and the arrangement.
Well, Stephen is really Stephen, and he was he's an English guy. He's a friend of mine now. He came through town and just stayed. I mean, it's just like the song says. He stayed for longer than we thought he was going to stay, and it'd be like, I'm leaving tomorrow, so can you throw me a party? We'd be like, all right, so we'd throw him a party. And the next day, like, knock, knock, knock. I'm sorry, I didn't take my plane like I was supposed to, but maybe we should have a party. And after a while, it was kind of like, okay, well, this is really is your last night in town, isn't it? And then the Klezmatics, I just heard, well, I've been listening to the Klezmatics for a few years and just loved their music and was looking for an excuse to get to work with them. And that song just seemed to really scream out for that sort of arrangement, although when we wrote the song, the arrangement was nothing like that at all. But yeah, I arranged it. We got the Klezmatics, or as many as we could, down to our house in North Carolina to record. And it was right after a hurricane had just come through, so we thought we were going to have to get a generator to record them with, because we didn't have power in our house until basically right when they arrived.
But it worked out good.
It worked out great. They weren't too happy about recording in a house. I don't think they're New Yorkers, and they were used to recording in a big studio, so they were kind of like, what, I have no headphone talkback? I'm not going to be penalized for what you don't have.
Well, this is Stephen's Last Night in Town, the Ben Folds Five.
He's charmed everyone here except Tamara Easter, who later revealed to him her innermost secrets. One is sober with stories about Linda McCartney.
That's a song by Ben Folds, the Ben Folds Five, Stephen's Last Night in Town. I'm wondering if when you started to write songs, or at some point during your songwriting, if you sat down and said to yourself, I want to write songs that are truly about my experience, not songs in the manner of another songwriter. So what are my experiences, and how can I fit that into a song? Could you talk about that a little bit and maybe choose one of your songs that you feel really talks about, not necessarily your life directly, but your more general take on life, or, you know, something that's connected to your world, as opposed to just an approach to songwriting that would be more secondhand for you?
Okay. Battle of Who Could Care Less. There's a dynamic around everyone that I know who is my age, who is, I guess you have to put in the Generation X category, though that gets to be a really boring, I get sick of hearing about it, but the less you care about something, the more valuable you are somehow. It's a weird little ethic that I don't know how old that is or when it came about, but it's really stifling. If you really try to do something, or you really put effort into something, or you express, you know, that you care too much about something, you'll feel this energy vacuum happening around you where everyone is quietly looking at you like, man, that's not cool. It's kind of like Cats. Not the show, but it's kind of like the way people love Cats because they don't seem to care about them. Or if you have a girlfriend and she seems to be placing too much affection on you, and then one day she doesn't call you, and it's attractive somehow to people. It's a really weird dynamic, and so I just felt like that was just a little too much for me. I don't like playing into that. I don't like acting like I don't care so that I can draw people's energy in. So I wrote that song. That's what it's about. The Battle of Who Could Care Less.
Oh, that's great. Well, let's hear the song. That's Ben Folds 5. We'll talk more with Ben Folds after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Ben Folds of Ben Folds 5. So what was in your parents' record collection? What did they have on the radio? In other words, what was the music you were surrounded with before you were old enough to choose music yourself?
My parents was Ike and Tina Turner, Earth, Wind, and Fire, James Brown, Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding.
You did good.
Yeah, it was all R&B, and I don't think they had a white person in their collection, actually. Maybe Janis Joplin is the closest to a white person singing that I very often experienced at home. Then when I was about, I don't know what age, I started listening to the radio and was completely taken by, you know, like Neil Sedaka and Carole King. And I discovered my white roots at that point, I suppose.
Did you have any guilty pleasures? Or maybe Neil Sedaka is square in that category.
Yeah, I don't know. See, I never really, Maybe this can be good parents' day. I've got good parents. I mean, I didn't learn a lot of really strange things that I think a lot of people learn somehow. And one of them I'm glad I didn't learn until much, much later was the idea of expressing your personality through your record collection or what you listen to. I just liked what I liked. It never occurred to me to be guilty about listening to something until well into my 20s. I started to realize that that's what people did.
I think a lot of bands, when they start out, really want to be different from the kind of spoiled rock stars who are petty and demanding and self-absorbed and so on. And then some of those alternative-type bands get sucked into the same problems when they make it big. I'm wondering if there are certain things that you are pledging not to do and not to be part of.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think the most important thing is just to be yourself. And I think that relaxes things a lot. And that might not make any sense, but there really is something to just being yourself, just relaxing about things. And if you're pouty, to go ahead and admit that that's what you're being. See, that's a good question, though. And I'm really fascinated with that because I'm like at that level where it's kind of like, well, we've got this hit and stuff. And I can see why someone would turn into a rock star baby, you know.
Why?
I think you can't rule out like just circumstantial things like not sleeping, mm-hmm. not being in one place at the same time ever, losing touch with your friends, losing touch with your family, and then basically. You know, stepping off of really kind of subhuman conditions on a bus, which people are like, oh my God, you got a bus, that's amazing. Well, I live in that thing. You know, it's like you're living with like eight guys on a submarine or something like that. And to step off that, and then all of a sudden you've got these adoring fans standing there, and all of a sudden, you know, you're in this kind of little I don't know, this little rock star position all of a sudden. It's very strange. It's really strange. I mean, it's weird. And so I can understand why people do that. My thing is, though, I don't want to act like somebody else in order to weather it. But I would rather just be something that I think is normal and attainable, you know.
Did you ever go through a period of trying on different personalities before you figured out who you were as a songwriter and performer?
As a songwriter, I've been unable to do anything but be myself. As a performer, yeah, the tendency to, I mean, it's really hard not to go just big rock, you know. It's like do the big rock star bravado thing for me because it's something that. I mean, I think I could be a pretty good actor, and I think I could act like a rock star on stage, and maybe sometimes that happens. But yeah, I've had the tendency to do that, but not in my writing at all. I can't stomach it. I can't sing a song that I didn't mean to write.
Before we heard your song, The Battle of Who Could Care Less, and you were, mm-hmm. you were talking about how you didn't like that attitude of being so kind of aloof.
Yeah.
And never showing a reaction, never being emotionally involved. So I want to end with a song that's kind of the opposite of Who Could Care Less. And that song is Kate. And this has so much energy in it and so much love that's expressed. Mm-hmm. It's a really buoyant song. I quite like it. Would you say something about writing it?
Well, yeah. I mean, this is probably not suitable for radio somehow, but... I mean, yeah, it was right before I got married. At this point, I'm in the middle of the divorce, but at the time, I just I just thought no one seems to write just like adoring, you know, love or crush songs. Not ones that don't have a lot of some kind of. There has to be some kind of irony anymore for people to write just like a crush song or an adoring mm-hmm. song about someone. You know, there has to be a twist, like in the middle, like you realize that he really hates her or he really, some kind of crap like that. And I just thought there's that moment, you know, at the beginning where you can see nothing but good. And that's one of the greatest things. And why not just express it in a song and get over not being cool? Yeah.
Our interview with Ben Folds of Ben Folds 5 was recorded in April of 1998. The band has a new CD called The Unauthorized Biography of Reinhold Messner. The band is on tour. Tonight they'll perform in Charlotte, North Carolina at a benefit for Kosovo refugees. The next few stops on their tour are Atlanta, Nashville, St. Louis, Kansas City, and Denver. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan recommends books for summer reading. This is Fresh Air. As we begin the holiday weekend, book critic Maureen Corrigan says it's time again to grab your sunblock and your bookmarks and head to the beach.
People who disparage so-called beach books tend to dump them into one category, trash. But those of us who revel in summertime reading know better. Only those grim literary critics who believe that pleasure is not a valid aesthetic criterion would say that the following books aren't good. And a few are so absorbing, you'll want to quit the beach and find a secluded nook so that you can give them your full attention. The Drowning People is this summer's The Secret History. Like Donna Tartt, who wrote her novel while still an undergrad at Bennington, Richard Mason is a wunderkind, presently matriculating at Oxford, where clearly he must be majoring in the Gothic novel. All of the ads for The Drowning People quote its prologue, the language of which is as overheated as a foil-wrapped tuna sandwich left out in the noonday sun. Listen. My wife of more than 45 years shot herself yesterday afternoon. At least that is what the police assume, and I am playing the part of grieving widower with enthusiasm and success. Of course, I know that she did nothing of the kind. My wife was far too sane, far too rooted in the present to think of harming herself. It was I who killed her. Our speaker is James Farrell, murderer and now master of the Castle of Seton near Penzance. In addition to that castle setting, Mason delights in other creaky Gothic conventions, a mad ancestor, a spooky portrait, and doubles, one dark, one light. Forget that Mason's plot turns on the same implausibility that inspired the Patty Duke show. Anyone who doesn't inhale The Drowning People in a few breathless sittings doesn't know how to have fun on a vacation. Let's turn from Gothic gloom to sweetness and light. Jan Caron's Mitford novels trace the well-ordered lives of retired Episcopal rector Father Timothy Cavanaugh, his wife Cynthia, and the eccentric folk in the mythical southern town of Mitford. A New Song is the fifth novel in the series and the first one I've read. That limitation noted, I'd say the Mitford novels exude the same kind of appeal as Agatha Christie's Miss Marple mysteries, minus the bodies in the library, or E.F. Benson's Map and Lucia books, minus the homosexual subtext. In the quaint burg of Mitford, folks still utter phrases like dadgummit and real-life troubles make their presence felt just enough so that saccharin levels hover below the toxic range. Karen's mild Christian proselytizing may get on some readers' nerves, but I just let the whole relaxing Midfordian experience wash over me like waves dissolving into the shore. Joanna Trollope's England is a more sordid place than Mitford. Trollope's latest domestic drama, Other People's Children, takes place partly in Bath. Though I'm straining things a bit, you might think of it as the kind of book Bath's most famous literary resident, Jane Austen, would have written had she been interested in marriages after the vows were uttered. Because Trollope sets her story in present times, the marriages and near marriages she chronicles inevitably produce blended families, hers, his, and down the road, presumably theirs. Despite how convoluted things get, Other People's Children is an engrossing story. Trollope really has a gift for capturing the messy process by which relationships evolve and sometimes wither. It's a wise novelist who recognizes when a series is on the verge of withering, and apparently that's how John Harvey felt about his long-running Charlie Resnick series. Set in Nottingham, England, the Resnick books have been a standout of the police procedural genre, suspenseful, psychologically nuanced, and wry. If this series had to end, I'm glad it went out with Last Rites, in which Charlie hustles to find an escaped homicidal prisoner, quiet gang warfare, and decide where his loyalties lie, romantically and professionally. Last Rites not only stands on its own, but also ties up some loose ends remaining from the previous 9 Resnick novels. While the Resnick series is drifting out to sea, another novel, presumed long gone, is washing back to shore. You just may have left a copy of Failsafe behind at that beach house you rented circa 1962. If so, good news. Echo Press has just reprinted the classic techno thriller by Eugene Burdick and Harvey Wheeler. The world teeters on the edge of apocalypse as a computer glitch sends American bombers carrying nuclear missiles zooming toward Moscow, and Khrushchev vows retaliation. Given our recent mistaken bombing of the Chinese embassy, Failsafe's white-knuckle plot seems to have dated not a whit. The really nice thing about Failsafe and the other summer books I've recommended is that they're a breeze to read, but not sleaze. Even if Harold Bloom were to toss his blanket down next to you on the beach, you wouldn't have to bury your head in the sand.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's archive edition was produced by Roberta Shurrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Kathy Wolf. Bob Purdick is our engineer. Alan Tu directed the show. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Tariq Rose.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Bantam Books, publisher of Rose's Garden by Carrie Brown, a novel about love and redemption, available in trade paperback. And from Reel.com, an online source for movies offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com, AOL keyword REEL. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air from Memorial Day, we hear how World War I changed the way war was fought. We'll talk with Neil Ferguson, author of The Pity of War. Then we'll hear from photojournalists Horst Voss and Tim Page, who were wounded in Vietnam and edit a book commemorating their colleagues who were killed documenting the war. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.